This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, poetry and PTSD. If you've ever read ancient Greek and Roman poetry, you know that they loved mockery, invective, and satire. Contemporary American poets, not so much. You don't read many contemporary poems wallowing in negativity. Negativity, particularly in regard to oneself, tends to be something to transcend. At least one exception is Alan Dugan, and to talk about him, I'm joined by David Yezzie. David's a poet and a professor at Johns Hopkins and the editor of the Hopkins Review. David, Alan Dugan died in 2003. He was well known, started in the early 1960s when he published his first book, but he's not on everyone's radar these days. So catch us up a little bit. Tell us about Alan Dugan.
Well, when he published his first book in 1961, it was a huge event, winning the Yale Younger Series Poets Prize, the National Book Award, and the Pulitzer. So it was really kind of a trifecta. But he had come somewhat reluctantly to poetry. He was born in Brooklyn, grew up in Queens in a kind of working class family that didn't really revere poetry. And in fact, he is quoted as saying that he thought as a kid that poetry was for sissies. So he had to kind of overcome this bias and wrote for a decade as he worked in different jobs. He was worked in an ad firm. He worked in a staple factory. And there's a certain kind of, you know, working class milieu that's reflected in some of his poems, as well as his experiences in the Second World War. He was a mechanic on fighter planes.
And we'll hear a little bit about that in one of the poems we're going to hear about his service, after his service, actually. There's a tone in his voice. We're going to hear him read a poem shortly. There's a tone in his voice that is very plain spoken, very unfrilly, very unpoetic in many ways. And I think that may be explained in part by his background.
It's hugely refreshing. First of all, it's as you say, it's very direct. It's very no nonsense, and yet it doesn't shy away from kind of larger considerations of elevated experience. It's just that there's no kind of hot air in it. He comes from a place of skepticism. There's a kind of caustic wit to a lot of it. It's very hard-edged. It's funny, people might disagree with this, but one of the voices I hear kind of lurking in the background, a kind of kindred spirit of a sort, might almost be Charles Bukowski, though Dugan isn't kind of as randy and self-aggrandizing as Bukowski often is, but it comes from a skeptical, clear-eyed place of kind of no-nonsense observation.
Okay, let's listen to one of his best-known poems. It's called Love Song, I and Thou. And it is, I guess it is a love song, but it is a poem about himself. And the operating metaphor throughout the poem is he built himself, his personality, as if it were a house. We have a recording of him reading it in New York City in 1962. Here's the poem.
Love Song, I and Thou. Nothing is plumb, level, or square. The studs are bowed, the joists are shaky by nature. No piece fits any other piece without a gap or pinch, and bent nails dance all over the surfacing like maggots. By Christ, I am no carpenter. I built the roof for myself, the walls for myself, the floors for myself, and got hung up in it myself. I danced with a purple thumb at this house warming, drunk with my prime whiskey, rage. Oh, I spat rage's nails into the frame-up of my work. It held. It settled plumb, level, solid, square, and true for that one moment. Then it screamed and went on through, skewing as wrong the other way. God damned it, this is hell. But I planned it, I sawed it, I nailed it, and I will live in it until it kills me. I can nail my left palm to the left-hand cross-piece, but I can't do everything myself. I need a hand to nail the right, a help, a love, a you, a wife.
Yeah.
Now, I have to say, right off the bat, I read that poem, I think in an anthology when I was a teenager, And I did not get the humor. I took it very seriously, and it seemed like a very devastating poem.
Right, a little pretty disturbing. Well, it is disturbing, but I think it is alleviated by a kind of self-ironizing. Yeah. And what moves me a lot about the poem is how the anger isn't directed outward. He's really blaming himself for his own shortcomings and acknowledging them in a kind of sardonic way.
Yeah.
Particularly when, and it's a very striking image, when he's kind of nailing himself to the cross as a kind of Christ-like martyr to his own undoing, which he himself has been instrumental in constructing, as if you would kind of construct, you know, like a house or something. And at that last moment, he reaches out for someone because he needs a human connection. He needs a wife. He needs a you, right? That's that Martin Buber kind of sense of I and thou, right? And he need, but why does he need her? He needs her to come and put the last nail in his crucifixion.
That is so dark. Now, one wonders what his wife made of this poem.
Right.
Can you imagine?
Well, you know, she may have taken some solace from the fact that he's hard on himself, first of all.
Yeah.
And so that was probably reassuring.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not going after her.
No.
It says nothing about her. It's about his own masochistic personality. You know, one of the most interesting parts of this poem is the section that begins,
I danced with a purple thumb at this housewarming.
As if he just hit himself with a hammer. That's building his own damn house.
Yeah, he's not very good at this building stuff.
I danced with a purple thumb at this housewarming, drunk with my prime whiskey, rage.
Now, we all know people who kind of hold their lives together and their personalities together out of being angry all the time. And that's what he's saying that he is. If it weren't internally directed, you would think this is like an angry white guy.
There's a real bitter edge to it, but there is something very sustaining about rage. It's poignant. It's sad, really. And there seems to be some acknowledgement of the defeated kind of melancholy quality of this, but also an acknowledgement that rage is a very powerful force and that sometimes we resort to rage to kind of carry us through. And that's a very human thing. It's not as you say, it's not that kind of elevated overcoming of foibles that we expect from poets. It's a kind of acknowledgement of a kind of baseline of upset and difficulty. And that really speaks to me. I think it's quite beautiful.
Yeah. And the thing about rage is that it organizes emotion. So instead of having a chaotic emotional life where you don't know what you think and feel, rage is a leveler. You feel one damn thing, which is rage. I've seen this in several people. It wipes out emotional complexity and it becomes kind of an organizing principle to one's emotional life.
And the corollary to a kind of inebriation, being drunk with rage. I think you make a good point that it wipes out all other more subtle emotions in a kind of intoxicated and destructive, possibly, state.
Okay, so you've chosen another poem by Alan Dugan for this podcast, and this one we don't have a recording of. It's called Family Scene, Young Vet and Relatives. And you mentioned that he was a veteran from World War II, so it has to be based on some sort of personal experience as well.
I think so, absolutely. And I think his service in Japan does figure into a number of poems.
It's very much a poem about what it's like to come back home and sit around with people who haven't seen war, and the weird disconnect that takes place between you and other people.
What really caught my eye in this poem is that there's a moment that reminded me of a number of poems by Anthony Hecht, who also wrote very disturbing, extraordinary poems about the Second World War. And there's a moment where he refers to this gun, which makes a sound after it should no longer be making a sound.
Let's save that, and let's hear the poem first, and then we'll talk more about it. Here's Family Scene, Young Vet and Relatives.
He will smile and corroborate the evidence as quickly as the expensive magazines that tell him weekly what he wants or knows. He will speak dramatically like a correspondent of his secret and meaningful time on the movie islands, among statistics of perfection and foxholes and no atheists and the great tropism to where he is sitting so happily and so contented now.
Let me interrupt right now. So this is, he's sitting among in a living room, presumably with people around him. There's magazines, and he's feeling the sort of, and he's saying things that are kind of what the media would say.
He's like a war correspondent. Yeah. He's like, well, let me tell you, right.
Yeah, and there's something, he's not saying what really he thinks and feels.
And Japan is the movie islands, right? It's all through the filter of media.
Okay, carry on.
Then he will callously repeat his notions from their lips, his life ambition and politer lusts, play back the phonograph of their belief, while in the closet his overcoat is hung, ready and fixed in the shape of his shoulders, while he hears, if he stops dead for a moment, the hate hawked on every corner of his suburb and the sound of the gun he thought silent. And as his name is called from the safe room, he will be arming for struggle and warning himself of what is to come, where he can go to meet it, or what is here already, tapping on the window as he seats a tipsy aunt at dinner.
So the poem really turns at the moment when he talks about the overcoat in the closet. And the overcoat suggests is perhaps a military uniform or something like that. And then there's the hate hawked in the suburbs. What is he talking about there, do you suppose?
As you say, it's really the sense, that very disorienting sense of returning from the experience to people who have only a very distant and filtered understanding of the experience. And so for their reactions to the war, which include hate, I mean, we have to remember that, you know, there was Japanese internment, right, in the United States. So what was happening back at home and being reimmersed among those people with their very distant and heavily kind of spun or filtered sense of the war is deeply upsetting to a person who's been there.
Yeah. Right? And then what about this gunshot? The sound of the gun, he thought silent. So some sound in the neighborhood is going off. What do you make of that?
Well, this is something that really struck me. And again, it's something that I've encountered in Anthony Heck's poems, is that, and it's very consistent with, I think, the experience of PTSD, that a triggering sound will send you back to the experience. There's a kind of re-experiencing that happens through some kind of sensory trigger. Or sometimes it doesn't even require the trigger. You're just kind of going along and all of a sudden, boom, you're back.
Yeah.
And so that is a moment, and I think it's another real hinge in the poem, where he hears the sound of a gun where there's no gun. He thought that the shooting was over, but the shooting isn't over. The shooting, he's still hearing shooting. And that is a very forceful illustration of the different experiences that he's having as opposed to the people here who know nothing of that.
And the final lines of the poem, he's kind of launched into another space entirely. And as his name is called from the safe room, he will be arming for struggle and warning himself of what is to come, where he can go to meet it, and what is here already, tapping on the window as he seats a tipsy aunt at dinner. Something has been triggered in him, and he's ready. He's got a fight or flight response going on right now.
Yeah, at the same time that he is being called upon to assist a woman, a wobbly kind of relative to the table. And so he's in both worlds.
Yeah. This is a terrific poem of PTSD.
I think it is.
Yeah. Now, there's one tiny little poem that I think it would be worthwhile to go out on, and he's well known for this poem. It's called Elegy. It's 4 or 5 lines. Would you read it for us?
Yeah, an aunt makes an appearance in this one as well.
Yes.
I know, but will not tell you, Aunt Irene, why there are soap suds in the whiskey. Uncle Robert had to have a drink while shaving. Now that's it's an endearing anecdote until you look back at the title and see it's Elegy.
And the implication is he had the DTs, he's an alcoholic, had the DTs, and not to cut himself shaving, he had to drink at the same time.
And one thinks that, you know, you think that if someone's drinking that much, you know, having whiskey for breakfast, that may have had something to do with the reason why this is an elegy.
Yeah. And then the other irony is that Aunt Irene didn't seem to notice.
Right. Right. She seems to have noticed that there were soap suds in the whiskey, but she couldn't figure out why that would be. Yeah.
David Yezzi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read poems by Alan Dugan and by David Yezzi on our website. David Yezzi's latest book of poems is called Birds of the Air. Do let us know what you think of this podcast, where our motto is,
I will live in it until it kills me.
Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.